Well, good morning, all. Welcome to the roundtable for this 3rd of July, the eve to the 4th of July. And it's very nice to have you all with us on this day. I'm guessing many of you have the day off, and I'm guessing that only because it took me like 12 minutes to get in today. So there's nobody on the road, and that was very, very nice. But I must say that we're thrilled that you are here. We're thrilled that you're listening to us, and we're thrilled that we can try to make some sense and go through the news of the day and dissect it a bit with a group of incredible individuals who are assembled here in Studio A. I will introduce them in just a moment. In the meantime, please remember that you can also be a part of this program by going to panel@wamc.org, panel@wamc.org. Now, please do not think that I am complaining. I am not complaining by any stretch of the imagination. I am just informing you, the listener, that I got a new computer, I got a new operating system, and I got a new phone. And all of that means that I have new authenticity, the new authenticator that has to be put in. And the crew is working around the clock to get that in, and they're doing a great job, and I thank them from the bottom of my heart. However, as of this very moment at 9:14, by the way, we got a new clock. You'll notice that it's now in green, which is very handy. That I have really no, I have some way of seeing the letters and the stories, but not really. So, if I'm fumpering around today, you will know that there is a reason for it. Now, if I were an absolute professional, you wouldn't even notice that there was a problem. But I'm not. So there we go. And I'm going to let you know. I remember Larry King telling me a long, long time ago. I interviewed Larry King when I was a kid in my first semester of college. And he said, look, kid, if you tell them you don't know what's going on, if you tell them something's broken, then they can't get mad at you for something being broken. Well, there you go. So that's the principle I'm going on, the Larry King principle, and certainly he was the fountain of healthiness, and I certainly want to do everything he did so I can live that long, healthy, happy life. All right. Good morning, all. Welcome. Let me introduce the group to you. We have Malia Dumont with us, and couldn't be more thrilled. She's Chief of Staff and Vice President for Strategy and Policy at Bard College. Good morning, Malia. How are you?
Good morning. Is that... I'm not familiar with that verb you used. You're fumpering around?
Fumpering. It?
Okay.
Fumpering. Yes.
All right. One of the things I love about this program, I always learn something.
Yeah. I think it's sort of like, I think of a rabbit with the big elongated back foot.
Yeah.
That's sort of going after ear. That's a thumping. But yeah. then it's also,
the
but it's missing
is like
the fumpering.
Yeah.
Yes.
Okay.
Exactly. Yeah. That's how I feel this morning. Mm-hmm. Wonderful to see you as always. We also welcome the Tetherless World Professor of Computer, Web, and Cognitive Sciences at RPI. Jim Hendler is with us. Hello, Jim. How are things?
I'm doing fine, Joe, and I'll have you know that according to Google AI, thumpering is the act of hitting something repeatedly with a dull, heavy sound.
There you go. That's exactly what we'll be doing for the next 3 hours on this program.
And it can also be a lot of other things, including a drinking game.
So, that's appropriate, too. Yeah, or I wish it were.
Everything can be a drinking game.
That begins, at noon. Noon today. We're thrilled. Thank you for that information. That's very, very helpful as we move forward. Nick Rangel is here, Executive Director of the Legal Aid Society of Northeastern New York. Good morning, Nick. How are you?
Good morning. I am refreshed, just coming back from vacation in Mexico, but we have our annual golf outing next week. So really busy these days. And if anyone wants to come play, it should be a great day.
So how do we do that if we want to play and we want to help your wonderful organization? How do we do that?
You can register at lasny.org, and we're playing at Eagle Crest. The check-in is at 11. There's a box lunch. There'll be a reception, fun games. One of the fun games we added last year was putting for bottles. So you don't have to be good at golf to come and enjoy yourself, because I'm not good at golf. But I play a lot. It's kind of shocking a little.
Putting for bottles. Excellent. Good stuff. Lasny.org to find out more information. A wonderful event for the Legal Aid Society of Northeastern New York, and hopefully lots of people will help out. We also welcome Wall Street investment banker Mark Whitman to the program. Good morning, Mark. How are you?
Morning, Joe. I'm all right. Summer's in full swing at our place. The garden's coming up. My son's busy at camps, so everything's in order.
Yeah, it took us a while to get to this point. June was weather-wise was turbulent, and so now we hope that we can ease in and have a beautiful July, especially now that it looks like we're going to have a big beautiful bill.
Oh.
Jeez, what a segue!
Ooh, what a segue! And he says he's thumpering.
Go back to thumpering. Yeah, I was
the policy bill that has taken up most of the oxygen of this program over the last 2 weeks as it moved through both the Senate, the House. The policy bill moves toward final House vote. Amid GOP resistance, Republicans overcame conservative holdouts to bring President Trump's domestic policy bill to the House floor. A final vote is still needed to approve the legislation. And goodness knows anything could happen. However, if you look at the tea leaves and the fact that most of the bags are packed and put in the back of the SUV that's idling at the Capitol, they're ready to go, and this looks like it's going to pass, but certainly we'll see. The House took its first step early Thursday toward a final vote on this marquee domestic policy bill after Republicans put down a revolt by conservative holdouts that had threatened to sink it. After a day and night of paralysis on the House floor and haggling and uncertainty in the Capitol, Speaker Mike Johnson scored a preliminary victory in his bid to overcome resistance within his party when the House voted to allow the bill to come up for debate. The 219 to 213 vote suggested that he had won the backing of recalcitrant Republicans whose resistance had stalled the measure, though the House still had to take a final vote to approve it. Representative Hakeem Jeffries, a Democrat of New York and the minority leader, was delaying the vote on Thursday morning by using his prerogative as leader to take far more than his allotted 1 minute to speak, assailing the bill as a, quote, disgusting abomination that would hurt Americans. Mr. Jeffries began speaking before 5 a.m. Eastern and has spent much of his time reading testimonials from Americans who said they relied on Medicaid and worried that cuts to the program would upend their lives. Facing tight margins in the House, Mr. Johnson could afford only a handful of defections on the measure, which would slash taxes by a total of $4.5 trillion, increase funding for the military and border security, cut about $1 trillion from Medicaid, and reduce food assistance for the poor. In the end, only Representative Brian Fitzpatrick, a moderate from Pennsylvania, joined Democrats in opposing the move to advance the bill after four other Republicans had initially voted against it, and several others had withheld their votes. Once again, please do not feel that things are okay. Things are status quo, because dysfunction reigned on the House floor into the wee hours of the morning, as a handful of Republicans opposed bringing up the measure and more withheld their votes altogether. But that seems to have passed now, and now we look at the actual vote that will come at some point today. Mark Whitman, I want to begin with you.
Thanks, Joe. You know, Joe, as summer started, I wanted to encourage my son to spend a little bit less time on screens and reading, and I was thinking about AI and all of its potential implications that I've been trying to encourage him to read Frankenstein. And it occurred to me literally the parallels here that this B cubed really is. I mean, if you think about it, right? It's a, pardon me, it's a stitched together abomination without a soul, and thus a danger to all of its creators. Unfortunately, amongst its creators are not only Trump and the Republicans, but sadly, the whole of this nation, which in a sense bears responsibility for what's about to happen. It combines parts that were long buried in graveyards, like Reaganite tax cutting, and also, you know, it finds more recent detritus on the floor of autopsy rooms and the Trumpian Steve Bannon populism that provide the temporary gimmicks that they're going to use in this bill. It's lashed together with more fresh detritus from the dissecting rooms, like the giveaways to individual lawmakers, including concessions for whaling captains. I mean, it's really a mess of mismatched limbs crudely sewn together. But like the monster, this thing has no soul, because Trump, it's like Trump. It doesn't grasp the true patriotism in this country as we look at July 4th. Is really based on empathy and a belief in the natural rights of all humans. Instead, you know, this creation and Trump himself really simmer with resentment and a craving for adoration, despite, you know, desperate to be praised and thus incapable, as the monster is in Frankenstein, incapable of love, life, or even a legacy for this country. You know, it spends more on Trump's cruel, xenophobic theatrics around immigration, And an antiquated military. Just think about that birthday parade that Trump threw himself. Those tanks are now, or will soon be, as antiquated as the Minutemen in costume in that parade. And we're going to spend more on those types of systems. Not only that, this monster is unstable and dangerous, not just to the economy's long-term health, but also to the moral integrity of our country. It lacks a conscience. You're like the monster in Frankenstein, right? It tries to mimic the language of the poor, but when it reveals itself to them, it terrorizes them. We're going to take food away from children. We're going to take the who need it. We're going to take health care away from those that are most vulnerable. And we're going to gut incentives meant to protect the planet. And in exchange, our future generations get the tax bill that we can't pay, but they will have to. And I mean, it's sad to see, like Mary Shelley's creation, this monster will inevitably spread destruction, first to its creator. I mean, I think clearly the Republicans and Trump will face a lot of backlash in the coming midterms. That's clear. But the real danger is much deeper. I mean, this thing, you know, America's entitlement programs face insolvency by 2032, and this abomination does nothing to resolve that. And more, even more importantly, the markets may soon respond here. Interest rates may rise as people wonder, the markets wonder about the ability of the United States to pay back its debts. The dollar may weaken, and the fiscal fabric of our country as we've known it may begin to tear. This thing is soulless, and our nation, and particularly the vulnerable, will pay a dear price for this monster.
I was benevolent and good. Misery made me a fiend. That is some good Mary Shelley writing there, Mark Whitman.
Can we go home now, Joe?
Yeah. I hope the rest of you have spent as much time writing your book reports.
I thought I was prepared, but here we are. I get up early.
You make such a great point, because it's a shell, right? It is this creation that many people have. And I don't want to say everyone, but when Robert Pondicio was on this program yesterday, and he kept on saying, nobody likes this bill. Nobody likes this bill. Republicans don't like this bill. Democrats don't like this bill. And guess what? This bill will most likely pass and be the law of the land and make a big, beautiful bill, which it's not, but will be sold that, and then have to live with the consequences.
Well, no one ever likes a budget bill or a reconciliation bill, and they are all Frankensteins. They are all like amalgamations of hundreds of different policy ideas and initiatives that really don't stitch together particularly well or cleanly. I don't think that's unique to this bill. I think what's unique to this bill is the degree to which people are very, very upset, but not enough people, right? Half of America has no idea this is happening at all, like in any sense. And I think we've been talking, everybody's been talking about Medicaid. Everybody's been talking about SNAP benefits, but we haven't heard as much about the deep cuts to housing choice vouchers, to the community preservation fund, to the legislation that allows Planned Parenthood to be completely defunded, and the impact of what that looks like in rural communities where these facilities are just going to be shuttered over the next 6 months because no one will be able to find different funding for those programs.
Well, and let's add to that significant cuts to research and science in America. The university system is going to be
decimated,
just torn
really.
Apart. Yeah. I mean, the research universities are already feeling a lot of pain. There's a lot of things that are being held up by judgments that now, with the Supreme Court ruling, are going to have to go back and be reevaluated as to whether there was a class, whether there was enough harm shown, da 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 da. So it's really, you know, we're just sitting here unable to do our work, which was really to build the basic technologies that would eventually solve major problems. Some of my colleagues who are cancer researchers are now job hunting overseas. My British friends, almost every day I get a letter thanking me for Trump's policies because all of the foreign students who used to come here are now going to the UK and Germany, the two schools, you know, the two countries we used to compete with. We're not competitive anymore because those students are scared to death that they won't be allowed to stay. You look at Silicon Valley and look at how many of those countries you had Indian students who stayed in America and created companies and worked with, you know, U.S. citizens, or in some cases, citizens by birthright and some other things, immigrants. Sergey Brin, who runs, who created Google, you know, came from overseas. So, I mean, we're just looking at stuff that has not only this short-term impact of, for example, making it so we have no idea how we're going to pay for my child's medical costs, to, you know, we have no idea how we're going to keep the research that could keep them alive with a disability disease that's primarily, the research has primarily been funded by the government.
We're going to take a break. When we come back, we'll continue. Want to hear from Malia, and we'll continue our conversation. We welcome you. Panel at WAMC.org. We will return right after this. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable on this July 3rd. It is 9:34 in the morning, and we welcome you. We are talking about President Trump's domestic policy bill, which is moving to the House floor for a final House vote, even though Hakeem Jeffries is continuing to speak and is holding up that vote as we speak, and as he speaks. And we will, of course, bring you more when that scene changes. We have heard from most of our group, but I do want to go to Malia.
Well, thanks, Joe. So there's many populations will be impacted by this bill. One that I haven't heard talked about quite as much is veterans. And of course, I have a special concern for veterans, being one myself, and also working really closely with veterans advocacy groups in the Hudson Valley. So I just want to share some information from an organization. It's a nonpartisan analytical group called the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities, and they've done an analysis of how this bill would impact veterans. What people may not realize is a lot of veterans statistically are more likely to experience food insecurity than other parts of the population. So in 2023, one out of every four veterans lived in a household receiving food assistance from SNAP or health coverage from Medicaid or the Children's Health Insurance Program. So this nonpartisan analysis says that an estimated 680,000 children of working veterans would be left out of the bill's expanded child tax credit. And veterans are generally disproportionately impacted by a lot of these cuts because they rely on more of the social safety net programs. They need more health care, which it makes perfect sense that a veteran would need more health care than your average American. Veterans experience higher levels of homelessness than other parts of the population. So, and veterans are disproportionately represented in the federal government. So if you've been in service in uniform, a lot of times once you retire, many people retire from the service quite young. You know, they enter at 20, 22. After 20 years, they get out. They still have a good professional working life ahead of them. And many of them want to continue to serve in some way. So then they join the government. And so they are disproportionately hit by a lot of the cuts to government jobs as well. So I feel like there's a lot of concern in the veterans community, just sort of bracing for how these cuts are going to impact that community in so many just different devastating ways, just piled on top of each other.
Can I just add two things to what you just said, just personal reflection on this? Mm. But I have done some work in this, and what I'm fascinated by, and fascinated isn't the word, it's sort of repulsed, I think, is probably the better word. But you mentioned of the people of one out of four that will receive assistance. But there are so many people who will not receive assistance because they're not going to. They won't seek it.
Right, that's true.
They won't look at it. And they don't even perhaps know that it is available to them. They're living in veterans' homes with other veterans, and they are looking and saying, we serve this country, and yet, I'm sorry, what is happening? Where can we go, and where can we move on? And then you add to that the food insecurity, and you add to that the problems that they have, of course, with health care, mm-hmm. and with trying to just figure out where they're going to live, and those problems are only increasing and increasing. And what they're doing in many cases is throwing it into the local organizations,
right,
like the VFW and other great organizations who don't have the means, don't have the structure, and don't have the experience to help this volume of people who need the help.
And those organizations are very important and have played a really key role for a very long time, but they have also been losing membership really quickly. And it's not because there aren't younger veterans out in the world, but typically younger veterans don't tend to join those organizations. So the VFW and American Legion are the most well-known of these groups. But if you stop by your local American Legion hall or your VFW, you're going to see most people there tend to be older. And it's a great community resource for everyone, but they have less and less capacity to fulfill these roles.
But also, much like the food, much like, and Jim touched on this, but much like the food pantries and the systems that are in place, those were supposed to be emergency measures. Those were supposed to be stopgaps. Those were supposed to be if you fall through the cracks. Those programs were not supposed to be the system.
Right. And just from a macro perspective, I mean, what essentially happens is when you're in the service, like, okay, I've signed up to help Uncle Sam, and all this funding comes in, and you are supported, theoretically speaking, you are supported as a soldier with everything you need to succeed in your mission. And the minute you leave the military, it's like you're discarded.
Yeah. I just want to note that actually tens of thousands of current military families use SNAP benefits as enlisted families.
That's right.
My parents were both military. We, you know, did not have means when I was little, because the expectation was, there's like this saying, it's like if the military wanted you to have a family, they would have issued you one, because you don't make enough to support a family. And so in 2019, the most recent data is like 22,000 military families were using SNAP benefits, and 1.2 million veterans use SNAP benefits now. And even further, I think millions of people use Medicaid in addition to their VA benefits, largely because there aren't VA hospitals nearby, and also medical benefits to the VA are often insufficient for most health issues.
And part of what this bill does is make it harder for veterans to get disability, which is already almost impossible. One of the reasons that, well, at least here in New York, I don't know about in other states, but we're lucky here in New York that many counties, like where I live in Ulster County, there's a well-resourced, well-organized, fully staffed county veteran service or office.
Yes. That,
they are county employees, and they are, and a lot of what they do is help veterans navigate the insane paperwork to get their benefits.
But there is only so much they can do because there's only so much that is available to them, which will seem to be lessened by this legislation.
But even just even with the help of the staff,
yes,
it often takes years to get through a disability claim. And part of what's happening now is trying to make it more difficult.
And add understaffing to that. So, you know, I've had days where my kid, my wife, or I have been on hold for the day waiting for somebody to come answer a medical question having to do with Medicaid, Medicare, Medicaid, or, you know, various drugs and which ones can be covered under what plans and things like that. So even just things that are fairly straightforward, IRS is, you know, good luck reaching them. And so the previous administration said, look, you know, we don't have enough people. Instead of wasting their time answering phones, let's create a system that makes it easier for people to file. One of the first things the Trump administration did is they killed that program. So the free tax filing. I mean, it's selfishness. It's, you know, it's
just
keeping
an expectation.
The rich richer.
It's
just unbelievable.
Just pushing so many things onto communities. And communities, I mean, of course, communities want to help the people that are in the community, but don't have the resources, and especially not on such short notice, to sort of absorb the impact of these tremendous, very fast cuts.
And that is just but one example.
Yeah.
Of the so many, the layers to this.
Yeah.
And I think you're right. This is one that has gone, hasn't been completely unreported, but certainly not to the extent because there's so much else and overall numbers that look at. Right. Mark.
I don't have a lot more to say, Joe. You could tell. I think you get my sense of how I feel about this from the analogy that just seems so apt to me. The one thing I will say is if you look at a lot of the theater that's going on, it took me by surprise when I read a recent op-ed. I believe it was by Robert Rubin and Larry Summers, and they talked a lot about what's going on with Trump. One of the more interesting pieces in the article was they said that DOGE probably, by its own claim, is left with about $180 million of asserted savings, far short of what they did. But the two Treasury secretaries said they're cutting the IRS so deeply that they will probably wipe that out.
Oh, yeah.
If not exceed that. So in other words, DOGE was a net loser. I mean, it's funny, but it's not. Think of the death of people, kids, children in needy countries around this world and the loss of soft power. And I think that is one thing that strikes me about the analogy between Frankenstein and Trump in this bill, is that when you're soulless, you lack the perception to understand what soft power is and what it truly does. And you don't value it. And I think sadly that analogy explains so much of what we're seeing in that individual and in his policies and in his movement. And I feel sorry for, you know, many of the vulnerable people who are living in that cottage next to the lean-to where the monster's been for a long time. It learned how to mimic their language, but now when it reveals itself to them, it's going to be very costly for so many of them.
And go ahead, Nick.
Oh, I think the global impact, you mentioned kind of internationally, but like the global impact on world economies, but also on the way we're perceived by, I mean, we all like have to manage our own household and our own bank accounts. And the idea that we would go into so much more debt for no reason, like there's no emergency, there's no pandemic, there's no, you know, urgency. We're just choosing to go into a tremendous amount of debt really diminishes our credibility on the global economy and the global markets. And we see that like playing out, like the value of our dollar is going down and has gone down over 10% already. The ability to sell that debt is getting harder. And then the interest, the how much it costs us to sell that debt is going up. And this is, it makes it really difficult to believe that the best interest of the American people in America is at the heart of a bill like this. Well, and then you have to look at what the actual tax credits are, the details in who is the benefit of that debt. Like, there's $1 billion in tax relief to the creation, the manufacturing of firearm parts. You're like, so we're going into this huge amount of debt. We're cutting all of these programs. We're literally able to count the number of people who will die as a result of these cuts, so that a manufacturer can make cheaper silencers, which will also probably kill somebody.
Well, you think about, again, if I may, sorry to belabor this, but you know, to think about Dr. Frankenstein, he begat his whole enterprise in search of accolades and a beast that would adore him, or an entity that would adore him, and he forswore his relationships with his own family, and eventually that lack of soul cost him his own family. And you think of what Donald Trump does in terms of the people he puts on the dais and those he wants the accolades from, and when this big beautiful bill is done, giving them their tax cuts at the expense of so many. It's sad how well the analogy fits.
And you know, we're looking at the fact that the Republicans think they're going to get a lot of this by, and probably will, by the fact that they're making a lot of these cuts don't start until after the next election, right? So sticking a year delay in there.
The midterms.
The midterms, yeah. So, you know, the midterms, suddenly you won't have felt that pain yet.
Well, you'll feel stuff.
You'll start feeling it, but no, a lot of the worst of it, the ones that are politically worse for the people in some of these swing counties, some of the things they did to get extra votes at the last minute are,
well, organizations
insane.
Are going to start winding down their programs,
yeah.
Right? You have a dead end date. I can't hire somebody for 4 months, right? So I'm going to have short-term internships or, I don't know, whatever, scholar roles.
No, that's
because
right.
A program has a termination date, and you're going to start to see organizations shutter, programs close, farms be impacted. Like, I think those will be felt before the spigot is actually shut off.
We'll take a break. When we come back, we'll continue our conversation. We welcome your letters. Panel at WAMC.org. I'm not sure I can see them, but I'm going to try. And we will get to that and much, much more when we return after this. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion. And we have a good one going. Malia Dumont, Jim Hendler, Nick Rangel, and Mark Whitman. We welcome your voices as well. Panel at WAMC.org. Panel at WAMC.org. Nick, you were saying during the break when we were talking about the impact on the VA, but we also look at how this is impacting student loans and the payback of those loans, especially what was promised so many people during the Biden administration.
Yeah, so provisions in the bill dramatically reduce. It ends two of the repayment plans so that you have fewer repayment plan options. So currently, if you are in a repayment plan, you can make payments on your plan for 20 years in the private sector, and you can qualify for public service loan forgiveness in 10 years, and those have to be qualifying payments, and they have to be on time and all these other criteria. And within those payment options, you can have like a graduated payment amount or an amount tied to your income in various iterations. This bill reduces the number of payment plans down to two plans. It also caps the amount you can take out in student debt for undergrad and graduate debt. So for law school, I think it's $50,000, which is a drop in the bucket for law school. And med school, it includes other professional graduate programs. And then I think, I don't want to misstate, but the cap on undergraduate debt comes down significantly, I think, to maybe $30,000, maybe $20,000. Right now, there's no cap. The cap is just what the cost of the school is. So you can go to a school that's more expensive and take out enough debt to pay for the tuition at that school. So by putting these very low caps on, you will completely reduce the options that students have of what schools they can go to entirely. Then it also, I think it cuts Pell Grants. I'm going to try to confirm that. Almost entirely, but certainly drastically reduces what's available in Pell Grants. I'm going to double check that.
But so you have to double check. I very much doubt that, speaking of like using the word Frankenstein again, this enormous bill, big bill, that the people who are voting for it or against it really have any idea of everything that's in it. Nobody knows everything that's in this bill. They're voting
1,000 pages.
Right. It's enormous, and so it's going to take quite some time for all of us to understand what the impacts are going to be. And I want to thank Mark for repeatedly bringing up this idea of Frankenstein. Frankenstein, what is Frankenstein? Frankenstein is this creature, obviously, but a fiction of Mary Shelley's imagination that was in a novel. And how do we learn about it? It's because of the liberal arts, and that fiction and the liberal arts can help us understand key things about the human condition. And another thing that is happening in higher education is because of all these financial pressures, schools are and universities are being encouraged by government policies now, but also by worried parents and students who have stopped thinking of higher education as much about sort of a way to learn critical thinking and more about a jobs training program. Like, how am I going to connect this education with a job immediately after I graduate, which of course is important. Everyone needs to be employed, but it completely misses the bigger picture that if you learn critical thinking, and a lot of that comes through a multidisciplinary liberal arts approach, then you can adjust to changes. Reducing universities, like there was terrible news just this week from Indiana University, which is one of the flagship public state universities in the country, renowned for probably having the best music conservatory at a public university in the country, really renowned for their foreign language programs. They're cutting over 100 programs from the university. And this is just sort of emblematic of what's happening across higher ed. And it means that fewer people are going to read Frankenstein and understand, you know, where that comes from and have that window into being able to interpret the world around them.
And let me take the other end of that, being at a tech school, not that we don't have liberal arts, but that the emphasis is on science, engineering, and art, music, management, relating to those things, is, you know, the effects on us is staggering, partly because of the funding cuts I talked about, partly because, as you say, the students are looking at this as a job program. That makes it so there are less of them who want to go on into beyond undergraduates to master's and grad schools, and especially PhD programs. Those are the people who are the key scientists, are the people who these things, you know. You look 10 years at, so, you know, I try not to get too personal about this, but okay, I have a kid with a disease that 20 years ago, they would have had a 20-year life expectancy. Now, their life expectancy is normal. Given that certain conditions don't arise, all of the medicines being worked on for those special conditions are now in programs at universities that are being held up, right? Our students were taking on very heavy debt to go to RPI and making it up within, 5 to 10 years easily because of the jobs they were getting in high tech, in things like that. Now we're seeing cutbacks there as well. But it's just, it's looking at the next 2 years and saying, hey, look, let's worry about that. And who cares about our grandkids? Who cares about that? Our kids, our next generation, our future. It's
but it is impact. I mean, it's impacting school enrollment right now, and what you'll see very quickly, an exasperated impact on the shortage of teachers, the shortage of nurses, the shortage of doctors, and other professions that you need to then go and provide these services, right? I mean, I would say also a shortage of lawyers, but I don't know too many people who are sad about less lawyers except for me. But myself, I wouldn't have been able to go to law school if I couldn't take the amount of student debt necessary to get through law school. And the only way I was able to do that was also because of public interest loan forgiveness, which I've been in public service my whole career. So people who have been on my path will not exist. There will be generations of people from low and middle income households who will not go to college and will not be fulfilling the workforce needs that this country does desperately need while we're also exporting labor sources en masse.
I do have a bit of good news from here in New York. The New York State Legislature, I think, passed this is a bill to expand the veteran tuition credit. So
yes.
Veterans who want to attend universities in New York have an expanded tuition benefit, so they can do that. Yeah, but that's not at the federal level, obviously. There's a lot of good things.
You have
things
to join
about
Trump's military first.
We'll take it where we can get it. Though. Any good news? All right, let's pause. We have a ton of letters. I'm going to get to those. Folks have a lot of thoughts about this, and I would like to.
But
share.
Can I just interject?
Yes.
I am not in Trump's military.
Thank you.
I am in the United States Army.
Yeah.
And I took an oath to support and defend the Constitution of the United States against all enemies, foreign and domestic. Period.
And I applaud that.
And how?
But sorry, I understand your point. But obviously, every time I take that oath, which I have to take every time I get promoted, it's intensely meaningful, of course. And I can understand why some people, of course, not everyone wants to join the military. But there are. Service continues to mean something, and I don't know what else to say.
I only mean it not, of course, out of any disrespect for people who choose to commit their lives to the country.
Yeah.
I think people are scared at his personal intentions and in the way he has treated the military and service members, how he talks about service members, how he talks about veterans, and his intentions on the world map and what he believes his authority should be in sending service members to police civilian cities within the United States, right? Like, we're in this moment where we're seeing just a different philosophical commitment to what service to America looks like under a president who has really, I think, diverged from precedent and from past leaders.
Yeah.
Well,
so
it's,
I encourage
it's those
folks,
heel spurs. I mean, they really.
There's two articles I would commend to folks. One was an op-ed in the New York Times earlier this week by Anthony Guerrero, who is an officer at West Point and intends to resign. Explaining why. And then the other one is an article in The Atlantic about an ethics professor at the Naval War College who also is intending to resign.
Guerrero's piece was staggeringly moving and important.
And you just have to wonder, and we're late for break, but you do have to wonder how long it will be, if ever, that it will come back and sort of fix itself so that that there isn't that feeling amongst service members like yourself.
Well, I can tell you what helps is that I'm on the Service Academy nomination board for Congressman Ryan. Every congressperson and senator has some kind of process because anyone who wants to apply to attend a military academy and get a free education in exchange for military service has to be nominated by their senator or congressperson. And so I sit on this board, and I've been doing that for a couple years. And there are continue to be incredible young energetic people who are not really paying attention or not interested in the politics around it, but want to serve, and they have a lot of energy and positivity to bring, and that gives me some hope for the future.
Let's take a break. We'll get to the letters. Thanks for the extra time, Ray. We'll be right back after this. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion this morning. And I just want to remind you who's on the program this morning. Malia Dumont, Chief of Staff and Vice President for Strategy and Policy at Bard College. Jim Henler, Tetherless World Professor of Computer, Web, and Cognitive Sciences at RPI. Nick Rangel, Executive Director of the Legal Aid Society of Northeastern New York. Nick Rangel, and Wall Street investment banker Mark Whitman. Mark.
During the break, I asked Joe if I could address Malia, and as the July 4th holiday approaches perhaps all service people. Again, here's a bit of a literary reference, but I always think of military service as a perfect example of Aristotle's notion of acting ethically, doing the right things, particularly because it's based on a fundamental, unwavering belief that people hold. And I ascribe to that so powerfully that if somebody who is a soldier decides that they don't want to be for reasons, I respect that. And at the same time, I respect those who remain in the military because of the arc of this country and then the mission that is that's pursued is so much more than any one administration. So thank you for your service to you and all who are listening.
Thanks, Mark.
Absolutely. Does it impact? I mean, you mentioned obviously the 4th of July, but you know, as we see those bombs bursting in air and we're celebrating and we're talking about independence and we're talking about freedom. Does it ring differently this year? Does it seem? I mean, obviously we have a lot to be thankful for. We have a lot. We still have freedoms. But it does seem, and this is the weakest term I can find, but just bittersweet.
I feel kind of nostalgic in a way.
Yeah.
I'm gonna be joining family at a small town Vermont July 4th parade, which is hopefully going to feel far from politics. And I think that's what a lot of Americans are hoping for, is just getting back to basics. It's about community. It's about supporting each other. And maybe we can, I don't know. I'm sure a lot of people are really afraid about what's going to happen, but maybe we can ignore politics for a day and just celebrate what our communities are about, you know. But it does make me think. I was asked to be this year's Memorial Day speaker in Saugerties at their Memorial Day observance, and Saugerties is a very pro-veteran community, so a lot of people turned out. Unlike in Kingston, unfortunately, where we had, I think it was like 24 people in the entire city. And it was nice to see that. And I sort of talked about, you know, why is this happening? Because a lot of veterans, a lot of people are sort of, you know, get get upset or wonder why are we losing the sense of cohesion? Why aren't people showing up for these kind of things? And I said, I don't think it's because Americans don't care about veterans. They do. But I don't think, like, increasingly Americans don't know how to care about veterans. Yeah. And I think that's in a larger sense as well. Like, a lot of Americans feel confused about how do we take care of our country? How do we care for each other
right
now? And I think the will, the interest is still there. And there's just so much confusion about how our communities are impacted by what's going on that people don't know what to do. I think that's why a lot of people retreat and stay home and watch television in the evening, because they just don't know how to approach all these problems.
Well, retreat is a word, but I also think become insular. But in the sense of that we want to keep our family together, and if that family is just within these four walls of this house, that we don't have the bandwidth then to move out just because of the threats and the perceived threats that are out there that hopefully someday will allow them to go out and to understand the plights of others. Mark?
As we think about current challenges to July 4th or the principles that are represented by the better portions of July 4th, let's not over-idealize where we came from. We were a bunch of rich, wealthy white guys who wanted to protect their wealth and preserve rights for rich, wealthy white guys. But somewhere in there, there was encapsulated the notion that there were inalienable rights. At the time, it was expressed as for all men. It meant white men. And that self-determination was critical. And somehow, when you hold on to that core and you look at what's happened through time, we've expanded that to an amazing notion of what we could be as a nation. And I don't think we should think any more pessimistically about today than we might have thought about it if we were at the first July 4th and in the position of someone who didn't have the same privilege. You know, the arc of history may well get us there, and that's what I celebrate on July 4th. Not necessarily all of where we've been, and certainly not where we are, but where we hope to go.
Mm. I just want to note that, and I just want to share that there are a lot of ways to support veterans. Of course, showing up and being like visible and present when we're honoring fallen soldiers is important, and taking a moment to recognize like the core of our democratic values. But there are tangible things we can do as well. Not cutting benefits that directly help veterans is one of those things, but organizations like my organization provide legal services specifically to veterans for issues that are particular to veterans and what veterans are facing. Organizations that are providing homelessness services, who are providing mental health and health care, those organizations need help right now because the organizations are at risk of losing funding and being defunded, but also closing and losing staff, losing the kind of people who are committed to public service, not just in government, but also in nonprofit service. So, like, I just want to encourage us to think more broadly or out of the box about what it means to support veterans, because supporting legal services that help veterans is supporting veterans, in addition to all the many other ways that we should show up for veterans and for our whole community.
Yeah. And you know, tomorrow on July 4th, I really thank Mark for his comments. And you know, why do I not despair? It's because I have that sense, like, we are still a can-do, problem-solving country. And so I feel like I can still make a difference. And I feel like together we can still make a difference. And so, like, that's what I'm committed to. And I hope everyone has that sense that they can see somewhere they can plug in or something they care about that they can contribute to. And it's still, like, there are a lot of places in the world that you can't do that.
Right.
And so we still have enormous opportunity to contribute in all kinds of ways, locally, and in a larger sense.
Go ahead.
I was just going to say, but we're also living in a country where the president is now threatening to deport the presumptive next mayor of New York City, or at least the primary winning candidate. Because he disagrees with the political views, which is, I happen to also disagree with that mayor's current political views on some issues, but we're talking about someone who was elected, who was chosen by the people. We're talking about voting. We're talking about, you know, it just boggles the mind that.
That gets into one of our other topics that you sent to us, right? The election.
Right.
Oh, yeah.
Issue.
You know, I think, though, that as we gather together, and of course, so many people do it different ways, but we have a place on a lake, and we have a lake community, and you know, we're all going to be out tomorrow night. We'll be out on our docks, and people will be letting off fireworks, and I'm sure they're legal. And they're going to be going off, and there are a lot of people there who didn't vote like I did, and I didn't vote like they did, but you know what? We're all together, and we're a community, and there is friendship, and there is love and affection, and a hope, and I think we sort of have to take that forward. And that's the celebration, isn't it? I mean, that's what allows us to come together and weather these bumps. I mean, to say they're bumps in the road is doing it a disservice, but to metaphorically say bumps in the road.
I would just quickly, Joe, agree with you and say, in fact, it's that loss of community is a big part of what's driving America's current politic. And I don't mean either particular side. I mean the overall state of the nation. You know, people used to live in the same area as their family, know all the people in the street, et cetera, et cetera. The world changed. It had to change. But now you're looking, you know, because I know I spend a lot of my time talking to people who are sort of between 20 and 30 who have moved from, you know, caring about trying to pair off to trying to find a community of friends, trying to find a place where they belong. And I think so much of that feeling that you just talked about, that gathering at the lake has just disappeared. And I think, you know, I don't know how you put it back together again. I grew up in different kind of communities. I have, you know, very different ways of dealing with that. But, you know, again, I look at a kid who's trying to find a job who's 25, right, living in their parents' basement. Their community hasn't grown. They've been through college or high school.
Well,
they
I
had
have
a
suggestion.
And now
for,
they've lost it and things like that.
For that kid, so how do you have to start at the lowest level. So I would just encourage everyone out there, if there's a neighbor on your street you don't know, take the day off tomorrow and just go knock on that neighbor's door and say, hi, I'm your neighbor. Like, that's how you start. And the community can't exist without that. I think a lot of people got to know each other during the pandemic.
When you're in your 20s, you're living in an apartment complex, you know a few of the people around you, but they're not your colleagues and friends. Many of them are different ages. Many of them come from different backgrounds. You're looking for somewhere to belong. Those somewheres to belong used to be religious institutions, used to be, you know, veterans clubs. Many of those things now are distributed, are online, are done by staying home. You have people who are immunocompromised who simply can't go out into communities anymore because of how we treated COVID. I mean, you can go on and on, but I think it's this lack of community and this lack of empathy go together. And I think those have really driven a lot of what are the problems. It's, I care about me and not about anyone else.
I want to preface my remarks by saying I realize that I feel truly lucky that I live in a small town. I live in a small town and I love living in a small town. But, you know, we have a coffee shop. And when I'm in that coffee shop, there are kids in their 19, 20, 21, 22, 23, and they're all getting together. And they're talking about really geeky stuff. I don't know what they're movies and different bots, and I don't know what they're talking about. But you know what? They're talking to each other, and there's a community, and there's a bonding. And I think If we can create those spaces, Jim, and I think if we can and welcome them and make sure that they're available to people, whether they be in small towns or in larger urban communities, that's really, really important to do.
I would just – I would – this is, you know, reminiscent of like Bowling Alone, the 2000 book, right?
Right.
I would just suggest that not everybody doesn't know their neighbors just because they live in a city. I lived in Albany for a very long time, and I knew all my neighbors. I was the life alert for the elderly lady next door, and we didn't know each other except that she was my neighbor and I shoveled her sidewalk. Like, so, you can do that. It doesn't matter what your age group is. I encourage people to try to do that more. But the other thing I would know is, and my sister is listening because my sister and my mom listen, and my sister mentioned this, she takes her kids to the traveling veteran memorial wall, because, you know, her husband is a veteran. He served in Iraq, and his brother served in Afghanistan as well. And like I said, our family's deeply veteran. And so Izzy takes her kids to the memorial wall, and they were the only kids there. And they're the only kids there every year. So not only are 20-somethings having a hard time building community and reaching out beyond themselves, but I think there's a whole generation of, and probably now two generations of young people who, where that's not being built in,
yes,
at the ground. And I used to go to the memorial walls as kids, and now kids are just not being brought to things like that, and they're not being brought to the memorial celebration in Kingston necessarily, or wherever, right? And I think parents and adults have to prioritize that over sometimes maybe like some part of the day at the barbecue, like spend the first hour going to a community-centered program.
We have a lot of letters, and I want to get to them, and I promise you we will. We go to Laura, who says, boy, oh boy, I do love Mark Whitman, and there's about like 8 exclamation points. And Malia's emotion was so vulnerable and real and moving. Wow, are you guys ever important? And that is from Laura, and we thank you very much for that. We go to Randy, who says, we all share Malia's pain about the vandalism and destruction of our beloved institutions and the pride in our country. We also go to Jonathan, one of the panelists, is speaking as if the Republicans are ignorant of what they're doing, and I don't think so. They want people to be ignorant and uneducated, to not be trained in effective thought and critique. Trump's, I love the poorly educated. They want to be unskilled because then we are easier to manipulate, to scare, to push around. The Republicans and apparently some Democrats are making the decision to choose their own political careers and possibly post-political, possibly corporate careers over the interests and the needs, the desires of the people that they represent who have elected them. It is selfish, it is venal, it is corrupt, it is cowardly, and it is characterless. Vincent checks in, you are not recognizing the existential danger we are facing. You are cherry-picking issues but not seeing the forest for the trees. ICE is being funded to a level above the level of the United States Marine Corps. Trump is building concentration camps, and people are already being sent to them, and others are already dying. What do you think the level of funding for ICE is meant to do? ICE will become Trump's modern-day Gestapo, and ordinary Americans will be subject to arrest detentions. He's already threatening to arrest the New York City mayor, as Jim mentioned. He is testing the waters for an all-out assault on anyone who disagrees with him. It is time to fight back. I would only argue with the first part of that letter of saying we are not recognizing the existential dangers. I think we've been talking about the existential dangers over the last, 8 years, but that's another story. We'll go to John. Oh, this is an interesting letter because it seems simple on its surface, but I don't know. John says, what gives? Republicans speak of this bill with all the great benefits, and then on the other side we hear of the downsides to the working class, etc. Where does the truth lie?
Right.
So, you know, somebody on the show, I forget whether it was two
days
ago. By the
way, I just want the record to show. I think Mark had the perfect response. It was just like, nah, nah, nah. Go ahead. Yeah.
Well, you know, it was somebody referred to the Gell-Mann paradox.
Yes. That was yesterday. Yes.
Yesterday. And I won't go through it again, but suffice to say, you know, part of this is you have to figure out the truth. And, you know, obviously I believe education and critical thinking and all those things are a key part of that. I think breaking down some of these bubbles, I often apologize for what some of the technologies I've been involved in have been corrupted into by large moneyed entities. But, you know, it's when you don't know what to believe, when you see a story you disagree with and on something you know about and you say that's wrong, and then you see a story on something you don't know about and you assume it's right. That was the Gell-Mann thing. We're seeing more and more, you know, it used to be, well, don't believe what you read in the papers, but at least you can believe what you see with your eyes. Now you can't even believe what you see with your eyes, given some of the technologies that are out there, things like that. We have people who are sitting there making assertions that are provably wrong. And I don't mean economic assertions where you have economists on this side or that side who say something, but where somebody says, there are 10,000 people who, and, you know, we have a public record that that number is either way less or way more, things like that. And then you watch the different news channels. I mean, you know, Trump at this point is even making fun of Fox as being too left-wing, right? I try before I come on this show to watch three or four different stations that represent different parts of the political spectrum, and I swear I'm living in different countries. And so I think underlying that message is, in fact, Joe, a deeper message, which is when you don't know who to believe, when you don't know what to believe and what you can believe and how to figure it out for yourself, your next step is to just listen to the person who slams the desk and says, this is true. And I think we're seeing a lot of that assertion. I mean, hell, we all die.
We have to take a break. When we come back, there are more letters I want to get to, and we will do exactly that when we come back. We welcome your responses, panel at wamc.org. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion this morning. Malia Dumont, Jim Hendler, Nick Rangel, and Mark Whitman, and a very special conversation that we're having this morning on this day before Independence Day, and talking about the bill that is moving through and going to be voted on at some point today by the House, and then will most likely, unless something radically changes in the next several hours, will be approved by the president by the deadline that he imposed. We have a lot of letters that we haven't gotten to, and I would like to get to those. We begin with Steve. Mark, the Frankenstein portrait comparison was brilliant. When an authoritarian, when an authoritarian-based person, thank you, who is tasked with crafting something as large and as broad as this, and that person is transactional, we could only hope that the thinking of others, senators, House reps, would tame and tamper the crafting with their longer boots on the ground thinking. Sadly, we seem to be marching and flying on the feet, wings of the left. The right will suffer too. I hope they remember that as they vote.
an ironic consequence of Donald Trump's loss in 2020 was it gave more time for Republicans with souls to attrit away, and he has now far more sway over what's left of that party than he might have otherwise.
Yes.
Just the Tom Tillis thing is just a more, you know, recent example.
Back to letters, and we go to Scott. A thought occurred to me that maybe it would have been better for Trump to have been reelected in 2020. He'd have continued his novice idiotic ways rather than giving him and his minions time to regroup and finish Project 2025 and put his orange exploding ducks in a row. Then we check in with Bobby. I'm someone who is working and I am barely making it. I'm also a veteran. I'm fearful for not only for myself, but for others in the same and worse positions when this bill passes. I do believe this will pass. I just don't understand why they passed this bill that the regular people don't want. Aren't the rich people that more important than the rest of us? I'm an empathetic person, and I try to understand why people do what they do, but I can't understand this. Can any one of you try to explain this? Well, I think we've been trying, right?
Yeah.
And we're probably failing miserably.
Well, so the tax bill will save the top 20% of American household workers about $12,000 a year, the top 1% about $290,000 to $300,000 a year. That's the latest numbers that have been published. There was a move to say the tax rate of 37 would go back to 39.5, which is what it used to be, only for those making above $10 million a year. The Republicans voted every single Republican voted against it. I mean, this is, disproportionate power by the oligarchy. And, you know, the richest people in America have always had their own interest. It's gotten worse and worse and worse since Citizens United. And now you have, you know, this chaotic issues that Mark so eloquently described at the beginning, and this bill that's trying to do it as a patchwork. And again, I think the point made that you're looking at more money for ICE than for the Marines shows you that it's all to promote the Trump domestic agenda and keep him center of interest and not to worry about what the future holds for our country.
So we've been focusing on sort of the specific impacts of parts of this bill, but nonetheless, like from a political organization perspective, it still holds true that there has been a migration of blue-collar workers and a lot of the working class away from the Democratic Party over the past couple years. And they have been supporting. This is why a lot of the Republicans got elected, because a lot of those folks think that immigration that's one of their big priorities. They've been convinced or they believe that that needs to be one of the key things that this country takes action on. And the Democratic Party hasn't yet come up with an answer for that. There's a lot of foot stomping about the terrible impacts of this bill. But they to back to the letter writer's point, I don't think that the Democratic Party has successfully made the larger argument.
Go ahead.
I would also know, I know a bunch of people who are interested in some of the like tax cuts or tax benefits or exemptions that they think that they'll be entitled to under the bill, because the GOP is pretty good at getting their message across. And so they're saying, for example, there'll be lower taxes on tips. And so tipped workers are, you know, pretty excited about not being taxed on their tips. But the details in the bill are being, I think, probably intentionally left out in those discussions because there's a cap on your household income to be eligible. There's a cap on how much of your tips would be precluded. And then it is phased out over time so that the benefit is lost within a few years. And so when you look at that level of detail, then you say, well, what am I trading for that short-term, small, and probably doesn't apply to me benefit? I'm trading these other losses so that there's a net loss in my household. And trying to put that together in a reconciliation process over a couple of weeks and several variations of the nuances within the language of the bill, which is very difficult and very large and text heavy, obviously, means that many people just hang on to my tips aren't going to be taxed. And that's kind of the problem, right?
Let's go to a few more letters, and we'll extend the panel to 11 o'clock because there's other things we want to get to here. But we go to Amber, who says, thanks to the members of the panel for pointing out the fact that many people in this country may be unaware of the bill and or what it contains. Can any of you provide suggestions on how those of us who are aware can help increase general awareness in our own spheres?
Well, Jim talked about listening and watching different kinds of news sources. And I like to read news sources external to the United States, particularly now where I think some press has felt under the microscope on how it reports on domestic issues. And I think hearing those different perspectives and also looking at news outlets from external sources is helpful.
Let's go to Jeff, who says, you guys are in la-la land. Tomorrow is a day of...
I was waiting for this.
Tomorrow is a day of mourning. America is dead. Your neighbors, half of them are your enemies. We are in the beginning of a civil war, and people talking like you are why we are going to lose. Today, you can be pulled off the street by the Republican Gestapo wearing hoods and masks and get sent to torture chambers just like in other countries. This is not fiction. It is happening today. Wake the F up.
To be fair, it was always happening. Like, there's been a percentage of deportations for decades that have been actually American-born American people every year. That's actually not new.
Just larger, more visible, more in the politics,
more in your face,
and
more sanctioned.
I think. Well, and also
right endorsed. Oh, yeah. Yeah,
right,
exactly.
Right. But,
yeah,
but
absolutely.
But see, the story is now okay. You're living in a rural community. And you're being told that the reason that you're suffering these various cuts and things are because all those immigrants are stealing your benefits, are stealing your money. And all these poor people who didn't work for a living, who don't have that correct work ethic, are, you know, those lazy people are still getting all this help from the government. I mean, these myths still hold. I mean, I thought that was going to be somebody telling us just from the other side. So hearing that we're not progressive enough makes
no,
me
they're,
feel
they're
good.
They're further so, down the pike.
Well, yeah, but I'm saying,
well,
but I think that, you know.
On the radio.
Yeah.
Anyway.
Yes.
I'm Mexican,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, yeah.
So
some of us may, right.
Boy, the subtext in that look was just priceless. Go ahead.
I'm Mexican, right? And I just came back from Mexico. I'm half Mexican. I just came back from Mexico. And I have to tell you that my whole family was extremely concerned about my ability to return to the country I was born in and that my parents and grandparents were born in. And I turned brown in the summer, and I'm getting close to a very brown shade. And there's a lot of fear about whether I like what kind of risk I put myself in, both going to Mexico for vacation for funsies because it's amazing. It's an amazing country. It has amazing cities. It has amazing food. People should go. And, you know, this fear about Mexicans invading America is nonsense. But it is also true that Mexican-American people do also have serious concerns about the rate of immigration in their communities, because everyone hears the same message. Whether you are Hispanic or Latino or you're white, you are hearing the same message that immigrants, new immigrants, are taking your jobs, right? And so these communities that have long been American and Hispanic and Latino also have those anxieties. And so, like, they're now at a place where they're saying, wait, I've been here for three generations. I'm as American as anybody else here. Why am I being targeted? Why is my community being targeted for, what is it, Alligator Alcatraz, right, which was posted on social media yesterday that all Latinos would be fed to the crocodiles. I mean, you know, there was this sense leading up to the election that American Hispanics and Latinos and people of color would be safe, and it would just be these other people that we don't know. And that's, you know, bearing out to actually align with what the campaign had been saying, which was we actually want to get rid of all immigrants. But even there, I'm not an immigrant, and yet I'm feeling more at risk, and there is more anxiety about my safety, my freedom, and my American rights just because I'm brown.
I'm friends with my mechanic, who's Dominican, and he was recently back in the Dominican Republic visiting family on vacation and called me from there because he and his wife suddenly they became terrified to get on the plane to come back. He's a small business owner in Kingston, very successful. His sons work in the business. They're a wonderful family. And they called me, of all people, because he remembered that I used to work in the Pentagon and thought I might have some special insight. So I think to part of the points that have been coming up in the letters, it's like, who do you trust? Well, this guy decided, you know, he doesn't know who else to trust, so he calls me. And I said, I think you'll be okay. And he's okay. But that level of anxiety, this guy feels like he can't go visit his own family and then safely return to his home, where he is a wonderful contributing member of the community. It just broke my heart to get that phone call.
Well, what's remarkable is how close of an economic relationship we have with Mexico, and how fluid the borders actually are for trade, for economic activity. There is this mindset that Mexico is this other, and that it is not. It is too dissimilar from the United States for us to be so interconnected, and it's a false narrative,
necessitating a wall to keep us from it.
Absolutely, and like I set up, and I would encourage all people who feel at risk right now is to set up redundancies and backup plans and safety plans, but to be a fourth generation American, to have safety plans because of racial discrimination right now is, you know, it's terrifying.
And by the way, I'll admit it, Malia, if I was trying to...
Are you going
to
call me? Should I expect a phone
call? If I have a 100-watt bulb and I'm looking and it says I should only put in a 60-watt and I become scared, you would be the person I would want to call.
Thank you, Joe. So.
Just, I feel that you have that... You have that strength. We'll take a break. We'll come back. We'll do a lightning round, and we'll finish up for this morning. We'll be right back. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable as we wrap up this January. Nope.
We should be
this
so lucky.
July 3rd. Yes, going back to January 3rd. Awesome, more time.
Maybe we are in La La Land.
July 3rd edition of the Roundtable, and as we wrap up.
Yeah, and I just, because we had to go to break, I want to note that African-American and Black Americans have been dealing with stop-and-frisk policies like what we're seeing in the rise in ICE activities forever, and have disproportionately faced unlawful arrest, wrongful convictions, and incarceration. And we've never seen the level of outrage at those many tens of thousands, millions of people who are dealing with this every day, who have to have a safety plan because they might be picked up off the street because they fit a description. It is new because it is targeting immigrants, particularly Latino or Hispanic looking immigrants. But the policing, the excessive policing in poor communities, immigrant communities, and communities of color isn't a new thing.
All right, let's go to this story. And as I said, we're just we're going into a quick lightning round. My computer was doing so good, and now it's not. I'm sorry. I'm going to just try one more thing. I thought I had worked. There we go. Okay, the Justice Department is weighing. Exploring using criminal charges against election officials. Such a path could drastically raise the stakes for federal investigations of state and county officials. And this is something that is being used. I mean, it's being explored, obviously, but this certainly is much in line with what has been talked about as far as voting in this country. So as we look to the midterms, as we look to the future and the future of voting in this country, of what it means for average citizens and Americans.
Elections in this country, there are election officials who are paid to oversee them, but they can't run without a huge cohort of volunteers everywhere. I used to do that when I lived in Alexandria, Virginia. It was a great experience. And every time I go to the polls here, it's volunteers who greet you, who give you your ballot. And the whole thing is overseen by paid officials. But I worry that the volunteers who so generously give their time to enable this key function of American democracy to operate properly are going to be worried that they're going to be in for some kind of legal jeopardy that is unfair and they don't want to have to deal with. And now when you sign up to volunteer for these things, the legal protections of the jurisdiction that you're volunteering with should extend to your work there. But I worry that it's going to have more of an effect than just on the officials that have that paid position.
Yeah, boards of election, right? You have bipartisan board of elections for each of the counties in the state, and then within those boards, there are a handful of staff, and they're usually at, like, you know, the level of staff that you need year round. Obviously, that need balloons when you have an upcoming election, and then for the election itself, and then for the ballot recounts that inevitably are necessary afterwards, particularly with mail-in ballots, where each ballot has to be counted individually with both parties represented at each table. And I also supervised some of these ballot counts during the pandemic. You would see dozens of volunteers in a warehouse where there's only a handful of paid staff from the Board of Elections in that facility, and everybody else is volunteer. And that the idea that you would criminalize mistakes that are made where there's so many protections, physical and technologically speaking, I think it's disingenuous, and I think it is intentionally trying to weaken the existing systems actually pretty strong.
I do just want to say real quickly that this particular issue is they're not talking about going against the volunteers. What they're actually talking about is right now, the states control almost all decisions about voting. Many of them are passed down to counties, things like that. That's why if you vote, in one polling place in Albany, and then you look at your friend who's over in a different part of the state, they're using a different kind of machine or they mark their ballots differently. This federal government is saying this issue is they're saying, we think we should own the right to say what kind of voting machines, what kind of protections on those voting machines, and what kind of validations on those voting machines are allowed. But they're not doing it by saying, you know, change the law to make it. So that's what happens. They're saying, let's go after the people one by one who we don't agree with. And that's, to me, when it becomes scary, right?
Mark.
I don't have much. These Republicans are trying to justify their hunt for Bigfoot, and I'm tired of it. And I think the article gives me some comfort because it said that the Justice Department couldn't find any law that could be used in the way they were trying to.
So far.
Not to say that they won't try the intimidation, but I think most election officials are going to be pretty comfortable proceeding as they always have.
I want to thank all of you for being with us and for sharing your thoughts and your expertise and your emotion with us. It is humbling to be with you, and it's a great honor to be with you all. I hope you have a beautiful Independence Day weekend, and I thank you so much for being with us.
And thank you for thumpering with us.
Yes, we'll thumper around together. That's what we do on this show. We'll be back right after this.